Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Current. I'm your host, Nadia Last, and I'm sitting across from Dr. Manesh Gurn. I'm so excited to welcome him onto the podcast today. I saw you speak at a conference, a psychedelic conference called the Harvest Integration Summit last fall. And as you were speaking, and you showed so much both passion and vigor around everything that you study, I knew that I wanted to bring you onto the show, and I'm so grateful that you graciously accepted this invitation. You call yourself on YouTube and on Instagram the psychedelic scientist, and I think that that name is so awesome. But you're really bringing in what is evidence-based, what can be measurable, into a space that is usually shrouded in so much mystery, the psychedelic space. So yeah, welcome to the show, Manesh. I'd love to hear a bit more about what brought you into this work.
For sure. Thanks so much, Nadia. Thanks for having me. My story, I got interested in psychedelics through an interest in meditation, actually, and spirituality. And I got into Zen a lot in my late teens through a book called The Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kaplow, which is kind of a legendary OG book in terms of Zen Buddhism and translating it for the West. And that led me to go down a path of just reading various things and being more interested in like big questions on, you know, what are the ways we can shift our perception of the world? What is consciousness? What does it mean to become enlightened? What does it mean to grow and heal and kind of expand and purify our minds and all these things? And naturally, I gravitated towards topics that were related to that. And eventually, I learned more about psychedelics and how they can induce these kinds of experiences, right? And at the time, of course, as a teenager, we've been told psychedelics are these harmful drugs. They make you go crazy. Stay away from you, away from them. And then I remember reading a book by Stanislav Grof, who's a pioneering LSD psychiatrist, his book, LSD Doorway to the Numinous. And in that book, he described in like very meticulous detail and academic language and very nuanced and well-articulated the different types of experiences that he encountered in his practice doing high-dose LSD psychotherapy through the 60s and early 70s. And it just like, I found it so mind-blowing and interesting. And then fast forward, I ended up working in brain imaging labs doing neuroscience research related to meditation and mind wandering in my undergraduate. And then eventually made my way over to the psychedelic field to do psychedelic brain imaging research that I'm doing now.
That's super cool. Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about the steps from undergrad to the research that you're doing now.
Yeah. So in undergrad, I realized pretty early on that psychedelics were reemerging as this really fascinating thing. And this would have been around 2014-ish, 2013, 2014, when I was starting to get interested in psychedelics and see them as something potentially scientifically credible to look at. The question was, where can I go to study this, right? And at the time, really the only main place or only place that it was happening was Imperial College London, right? Where Robin Carhart-Harris, who's my current supervisor, did the first ever fMRI brain imaging study of psilocybin in 2012 and had ongoing research related to it, which, you know, was really like a watershed moment of, wow, like there's actually legitimate researchers studying this. It's getting a lot of attention. I want to join this. I want to get in on this exciting new thing.
What were they seeing in that image at the time?
Originally, the big finding was that after psilocybin, the participants only showed decreases in brain activity and no increases. So at the time, this was astonishing for everybody because like, oh, psychedelic experience is so complex, so intense. How can it be related to reduced activity? And now like that particular finding has not necessarily, it's more complicated than that now. Like we know that. It's not necessarily that's the case. That's the answer for all psychedelics and all psychedelic experiences. It's much more nuanced and we can get into that. But at the time, people were like, oh, it means it's probably turning off the brain's filtering mechanism of consciousness and energy that's coming in. And therefore, it's opening us up to perceive more and opening the doors of perception and all that. There could very well be something like that going on, but the picture seems more complicated now. But that finding did make a big splash back then.
Yeah. And then so that happened in 2012. And where did that take you from there?
So then I was like, huh, brain imaging seems to be a cool thing to start studying psychedelics. So it's more objective, it's grounded, like we're looking at the brain. It's not purely psychology, it's not purely, you know, subjective. I realized the only way I could study it is to go to London. But at the time, there was no funding available for people who are not from the EU, right? And I'm Canadian. And so I couldn't really go there. So then the question I asked myself is, what can I do for grad school. And in the meantime, that will best help inform psychedelic research, right? That's not directly psychedelic research, but adjacent and relevant. And I honed in on studying the default mode network, which is this really interesting network in the brain that's involved in a lot of the complex cognitive processes that make us human. So like our ability to think about something that's not in the here and now, imagine the future, remember experiences from the past, construct a personal narrative of who we are, and you know, think about the mental states of other people, and really just our capacity for abstract conceptual thinking. And I was like, this is the coolest network. I want to study this network. I don't want to study something else. And so my PhD, which I ended up doing at McGill University, because they have the top neuroscience program in Canada, I went there and I was able to get more funding, some Canadian. And so I did my PhD on the default mode network. But while I was there, I was like, I can't wait. I don't want to wait for after my PhD to start psychedelic research. And so very early on, actually even before grad school, I wrote a proposal for a paper to collaborate with Robin Carhart-Harris, who's the lead researcher. And me and my supervisor at the end of undergrad actually sent it to him. And then I ended up publishing a paper with him on psychedelics and creativity before I even started grad school. And so, and then that connection grew into, I think, maybe two or three other papers throughout grad school that I published with him related to psychedelics, even though I wasn't in a psychedelics lab. And so I kind of did what I could to like create that for myself. And then once I finished my PhD, he was like, I would love to have you. And here I am. And he moved to San Francisco in the meantime. And so I'm here now working with him.
So happy you're in the Bay. And I think for anyone listening, there's something so powerful in that story, Manesh, that you created your own opportunity in a sense. You came up with this idea, you shot your shot, and it ended up to where you are now.
For sure. I think the most important thing for anybody is to be proactive and to be ballsy, right? To like push the edge of what you think is reasonable for you to do. Because usually people will appreciate that and they'll appreciate the boldness, and you know, you don't get what you don't ask for, right? And so that's been a huge theme in my life for sure.
And the conviction and the passion that this person must have read, who's now your supervisor in your proposal. It's really cool.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm curious on sort of, you know, fast forwarding from when you first read this book on Zen that you were talking about to now, what were sort of the psychedelic experiences you might have been having personally that were also aiding in your continued interest in this field?
Yeah, that's an important point. I left out of that story. Actually in high school, at the end of 10th grade, I had a mushroom experience at the beach with some friends. And at the time, I had a bit of a meditation practice going. I'd read some books on Eastern spirituality. And then a friend of mine, she got some mushrooms off her older sister. And we're like, oh, let's do it at the beach, right? And long story short, that experience allowed me for the first time to step back from this character named Manesh and his beliefs, his thoughts, his perspectives. And I was able to like see from almost a third person perspective that I, like everyone else, we're thrown into this life. We have no clue what's going on. We just wake up every day and do what we think is normal according to this culture. But it's like, where do we come from? What is consciousness? Who are we? We have no idea. We're just living our lives as if we did, but we have no clue what's going on. And I remember being at the beach, and it was actually Canada Day, and there were fireworks and all that. And people at the beach, a lot of them were like, you know, drinking alcohol and like super rowdy and loud. And they're all just hollering at these fireworks in the sky. And I was just thinking to myself how absurd the situation is and how we're just a bunch of primates on this beach, on this flying rock in space, hollering at lights in the sky. And we think we're so advanced that we know what's going on, but we haven't got a clue. We're just another species of animal that just emerged on this planet. And I don't know, that experience was just like profoundly fascinating to me and made me much more introspective and reflective in terms of how our perception creates our reality and different ways of perceiving life and operating and kind of seeing beyond the tunnel vision that we operate in. So that experience really was a huge stimulator of my curiosity about these things and what probably led me to want to study them.
Yeah. Just like the brain imaging was that watershed moment, as you mentioned, for psychedelics, that was the watershed moment maybe for you kind of uncoupling yourself from the identity you always knew up until that point.
Yeah. And seeing this potential, the potential of conscious experiences that we can have way beyond just our regular normal consciousness, right?
What are other tools that you've used to explore the expansion of your consciousness, maybe other medicines or other tools like meditation?
Yeah, throughout my 20s and still, I've always actively sought out different transformational tools and contexts and all the things. I think the biggest influence on my development in my 20s has been joining men's groups, actually. So there was a men's group organization that I joined in Vancouver, where I'm from. And having a context where, you know, at age, I think I joined at 22 or something, where I can go in and share what's going on for me in just like a fully vulnerable, honest, authentic way, sharing fears and anxieties, and having a group of men, in this case, like, you know, maybe 15 to 20 others who I see every week, who are there to reflect back to me and support me and hear me and, you know, give me some fire if I need it and challenge me and hold me accountable. And just having that every week really made a huge impact, especially since I was the youngest person in there most of the time. And that was like 22 to 25. I was a part of that in Vancouver-ish. And then when I moved to Montreal for my PhD, I started it in Montreal and led a group of, at one point, up to 18 men that meet weekly to support each other and share these things. And that whole step into leadership was a whole other transformational process with its own teachings and learnings and challenges, right? And so I feel like that, although not necessarily consciousness altering, made a huge impact on me. And in addition to that, you know, adjacent to that, I've gone to multiple ayahuasca retreats. I've sat with it, I think, 7 times, 5-MeO retreats, many mushroom journeys intentionally and just for fun as well, of course. LSD journeys, same thing. Done breath work many times. And I've also been a daily meditator since I was 19-ish. And that's a major part of my life. And other workshops and things. And just like, I'm always throwing myself into new contexts to grow and expand and be challenged and pushed out of my comfort zone. And that's basically the story of my life.
It's an amazingly sort of synthesized one. And I could feel it in your energy as soon as you said yes to coming onto this podcast, for instance. And I think it's helpful for people just to hear a menu like that. Like you just listed off all these different menu items, which are a universe in and of themselves. I'm curious what's part of your practice currently that's keeping this inner creative connection alive?
Yeah. So, I mean, the cornerstone of my life is my morning practice. So I always, these days, it's varied. The length of it is varied, but like the past while, half an hour of stretching / yoga, half an hour of meditation and a cold shower every morning, no matter what. And I don't look at my phone until at least, I have it on airplane until after all that. So I'm awake for at least an hour and a half before I even look at my phone, which I think is so important because what you do in those first hours of waking sets the momentum for the rest of your day and is so important for grounding. And so I really prioritize that. I meditate throughout the day. I work from home mostly, so I'll just like get up and sit on my mat and meditate for 5 or 10 minutes in the middle of the afternoon and do that. And in addition, I'm very active. I run all the time. Go on, you know, half an hour to 45 minute runs a couple of days a week. I go to the gym 3-4 days a week, do yoga and stretching, as I mentioned, play guitar, like half an hour to an hour most days. I keep myself active, but with a good balance between self-care and work. And I'm always prioritizing self-care and myself and investing in myself. And in addition to all that, journaling a lot. I've also had therapists of varying sorts that I see almost weekly that I have for 3 years, the past 3 years. And not necessarily because I'm struggling with any mental health conditions. I think everybody should have a therapist of some form that they see for their own awareness and development and growth. And so I do it purely from that perspective of like, there's always stuff coming up. There's always things to gain greater insight on. There's always stuff to work through and make more explicit. And so I'm always just trying to, just become more present, aware, centered, grounded, heart-centered. All the things.
That's incredible. I feel like for people listening, they're probably asking, how do you fit all of that in a singular day? And it's so impressive. And are there weeks where you fall off?
Right. I mean, I'm not perfect every day, of course, and I do fall off. And I think my personality type is really good for structure in terms of making a schedule and sticking to it. And I've always been like that. And I'm very grateful for that. And so I just have routines that I've had for 10 years. So it's just very easy to wake up and meditate and stretch and do that. It's easy to have a productive day from 9 till 4 or 5 and then being able to completely forget about work for the rest of the day and do other things. Like I'm good at compartmentalizing and focusing at different parts of my day. I think part of it is because I have a lot of energy and I enjoy what I do. I don't feel drained most of the time after a day, unless I'm doing something, you know, we all have stuff we don't want to do, but in general, I'm passionate about the work I do. I'm living the dream to being a psychedelic researcher. I have a lot of flexibility with my time and I've curated my life to be energizing. I think that's what allows me to do so many things.
Yeah. I think that's really inspiring for people to hear, is that you've slowly, little by little, maybe it started with the meditation practice. I feel like that's the first tool I heard that emerged in your life. And you've been adding and really taking stock of what energizes, what is life giving for you in terms of work that then kind of spills over into the other parts of your life.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's been a process for sure. I didn't wake up with all these things in place. It's been, yeah, a lot of years.
Beautiful. I also think what you're saying about not having your phone for the first hour and a half of a day, I'm like reflecting on my own life of how much more I probably could use time without the phone. I think it actually relates a little bit to the default mode network in our brains and what happens after a psychedelic journey where you have this opportunity. Each day is a fresh start. And what do you put into your brain and in your psyche as a way of kind of dictating the way your day is going to go? I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that and how that works in our brain.
For sure. I mean, how I think about it is kind of how you described. It's like a lot of our mental life and our well-being is momentum. And one way of understanding psychedelics is that they shift the momentum. They break up the pattern that we were in and allow us to crystallize and form a new pattern, right? And we can link that to the experience itself, which, sure, maybe the default mode network is less integrated. And so our usual patterns of thinking and perceiving the world and our usual perspectives are shooken up for that experience. And based on the nature of the context you took it in and your intention, when you come out of that, you're going to have a new set of insights and perspectives that now you can work into your default functioning. And that's what we call integration, right? And so it's kind of this like pattern disrupting mechanism that allows you to instantiate new patterns. But of course, that takes effort and focused, conscious stuff you have to do after. It doesn't happen automatically, right? You don't need psychedelics to break up the momentum, like any negative momentum you have, or to create new patterns. It's like, as you were saying, like very well, like every morning you wake up and then it's like, okay, what things do you want to set in motion for yourself that day? And I know for myself, if I, you know, wake up and like drowsy, take my phone and start scrolling through Instagram, my entire day, I'm going to be more distracted, a bit more restless, a bit more impulsive, more likely to go on my phone in general, and just not in as good of a place, right? And because that was the baseline you set. And then unless I come out of that and then meditate for half an hour or go for a run and do something to disrupt it, that's just going to keep progressing. And then you do that for weeks and then months, and then it turns into all sorts of mental health issues, really. And so I think really being conscious of what patterns you're feeding and how that's building is so important from the moment you wake up.
Yeah, I'm seeing it like a trickle of water that creates a small stream, that creates a river, that creates this like riverbed that's really established, where it's like these patterns over years really does take a toll on our psyche.
Yeah. And on the other side, it could be a beautiful, positive things you're creating in your life, right? Which support your highest expansion in self. And that's what you want to switch into. It's like, what are those practices that I could encode deeply into my brain such that they become automatic?
What happens, this is now all of a sudden about habits, but I'm curious for you mentally, what happens if you're like, oh, I don't want to play the guitar, but I know it's good for me. I know that, are you at a point now where it's just muscle memory and your brain isn't as much in the bargaining and negotiation process?
You know, it's interesting. When I was younger, I was more of a slave driver for myself. Like I'd be like, 8 till 9:30 is guitar time, no matter what. And I would do it. But I'm much more lenient for myself these days. And I really believe in prioritizing self-care, because it always comes back to, it's like, I don't have to play guitar today. Nobody's making me do it. It won't, in the grand scheme of my life, it's not going to make a massive difference, right? And so if one night I don't feel like playing guitar, I don't play, and I have absolutely no guilt around it. And it's like, okay, today I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. I watch something on Netflix or like lie there and just do absolutely nothing for an hour. which is fun to do sometimes for sure. And so I have gotten to the point where if I feel like doing it is going to drain my energy and I don't absolutely have to do it, then I won't do it. I won't force myself. Whereas I used to, this is like post-pandemic, Manish. Before pandemic, I was not like that. I was like super rigid. But what it comes down to in the end is like, why do you want to do it? And your hierarchy of priorities and values, right? If I value being energized, feeling good mentally, not burning myself out, and enjoying my life, then why am I going to drive myself to do all these things I don't have to do and I don't want to do? So what am I doing that for? That's kind of how I operate now. If I don't feel like it, I'm like, okay, I just won't play guitar today or this week. I'll come back when I want to. And there's so much freedom in that. It's like so much lighter and easier to live like that, to give yourself permission to do that.
It sounds like the pandemic was another one of those interrupters of patterning for you mentally.
Yeah, definitely. Because left to my own devices in the pandemic, where I'm just like in my apartment all the time, I went hyper rigid structure, right? And I got a lot of stuff done in the pandemic. I launched my YouTube channel in the pandemic. I did a 6-month stint as a life coach during the pandemic. I did a whole bunch of things. But then kind of like burnt myself out, right? Because it's like I had nobody to interrupt myself. That combined with my girlfriend at the time kind of helped me pull out of that. And then there's no going back. I saw like a lot of that drive towards hyper rigidity, hyper overachieving, hyper perfection. It's all based in, you know, in wounding and insecurity and a desire to be perfect, to prove to yourself and the world how great you are. Right. And all those patterns. And so like a major part of the pandemic was acknowledging those within me and working through them and coming back to the motivations I mentioned before of like, what is driving your behavior? Is it a desire to be perfect and prove to everyone how amazing and, you know, flawless you are? Or is it to enjoy life and make a positive impact and et cetera, right? And like the way you behave in either of those contexts is going to be very different. So that was the post-pandemic switch for me, for sure.
It's huge. It's huge transformational work to be able to look at that in the mirror and say, to be honest, the root of this rigidity is actually a desire for perfectionism and a desire to be important or to matter or to prove my worth.
Yeah, which comes from fear and pain. And it's just a matter of acknowledging and exploring that and being able to process it, really.
It's really powerful. I feel like we could go on a whole exploration of that fear, but I do also want to talk about what's exciting you right now in the field of psychedelic study and how beautiful that you have so much appreciation that you're here as a scientist, that you get to study such an interesting burgeoning field. I think maybe where I'd want to start is, from my understanding, and let me know how true this is that we did have studies that were happening in, you know, the 60s and maybe the 70s. And that at some point the war on drugs kind of interrupted all of this. And now it's like a spring awakening for psychedelics again. So I'd love to know a bit about what's interesting you in this field right now.
For sure. And yeah, you're very right. Like from the first ever report on LSD, which started the early psychedelic science surge, was 1947. And from 1947 until the Controlled Substance Act of 1970, which outlawed psychedelics, there was over 1,000 research articles published with over 40,000 subjects or something like this. And so it was a massive wave that didn't shut down for partially academic reasons, which is a whole other topic, but also social and political ones with the Nixon administration and anti-war protests and all the things, right? And only, you know, it restarted in around particularly 2006, and then really took off in the last 10 years or so. For me right now, and in general, what I'm really interested in is how psychedelics work, right? There's a question of, do they work as a treatment for X, Y, or Z? But then there's a question of, how do they work? How do they affect the brain and why, and how does that relate to the particular experiences people have, and how and why does that relate to, you know, transformation and healing and all the rest? And so this is what I do with Robin Carhart-Harris at UCSF down here. And a cool project we're looking at now is really collecting a lot of brain data on people as they go through 4 successive psychedelic journeys with psilocybin. We bring them in for a journey in the scanner and all the rest every week for 4 weeks. And then we do that for 10 people. And we're trying to see, one, how does a person's brain effects and experience change over the course of an experience? And then how does that itself change over multiple experiences? And how does that whole thing differ across people? And so we're really trying to get into the nitty-gritty here on multiple layers of the dynamics of the psychedelic experience and the different ways our brains can respond to it and our minds and how this all relates to outcomes and all that. So this is a really cool project where we're collecting a lot of data and there's a lot of stuff that we're going to analyze. And so that's the main project I'm on right now in terms of collecting data. In addition to that, I have a lot of people I collaborate with on paper, on papers and data sets collected elsewhere. One really fun paper that I'm excited about is with a doctor named Dr. Devin Christie. She's a functional medicine doctor based in Canada and works in the psychedelic space, is as a teacher and facilitator, and was on the MAPS for MDMA trials and all of that. She's awesome. And her whole thing is bridging somatic and relational and trauma-informed and trauma-focused psychotherapies into psychedelic therapy. And she had written some materials and has like taught mini courses and things. And I know she's about to start being an instructor for a somatic psychedelic certificate program, I believe, for the Embody Lab, which is a very popular online website you might have heard of. I am working with her to bring all of her work and make it into something that's publishable. And also provide a neuroscientific framework to understand everything that she does and she talks about. So a neuroscience framework for somatic therapy. And I think that's really interesting and fun because I think it's not emphasized enough, somatic therapy and somatic effects in psychedelics. And I know from my own journey, the biggest transformation and change has come through like the body, right? Emotional expression, processing energy in the body, not just through thinking and talking about it. Like I could think and talk about and verbalize all I want, but that doesn't create real transformation. What real transformation is like feeling, going into the feelings, expressing it and releasing energy. And that's not acknowledged enough in psychedelic therapy. And so like I'm big on trying to make that more visible and also bridge it with the neuroscience.
Such a cool task, such a creative challenge to figure out how to take this offline work and make it neuroscientifically constructed and contained. I'm curious, the somatic process, of course, the expression of emotions, but what are the typical things that you're seeing from people during the journey and then perhaps afterward?
Yeah, I think a common thing is people feel have muscular discharges during the experience. They might just like be twitching a bit or have some weird physiological muscle spasms and things going on. People might even have, especially at higher doses, the feeling of energy moving to a part of their body and just like feeling a lot of sensation there followed by some kind of release, right? And often people might have memories and emotions that then get linked to a part of the body and that somehow gets released and processed in the experience. And then there's also like realizations of all the holding patterns that we have in response to different stressors or traumas from early in our life. As an aside, it's really interesting, like from what I've heard, machine learning algorithms, based on somebody's gait, like how they walk, they can tell so much about somebody just by the nature of their walk, because there's so much information encoded in how we hold ourselves and how we move. Intuitively, empathically, we pick up on that a lot. You can tell somebody's agitated just by the nature of how they walk, right? And these are often trauma stored in the nervous system that hasn't been released. And to release that, you don't release that by thinking about it, right? You release that by shaking, moving, doing all sorts of things, yelling. And I think these things play a core part in the therapeutic process, and we don't talk about it enough.
Yeah, because we're in these animal bodies, these mammalian bodies, and so we forget that there's this animal that we're the steward of, that we're embodied within, and that, you know, if anything happens to an animal in the wild, for instance, they need to shake it off. They need to, like, mm-hmm. My dog, if I pet him for too long, I'll know because he shakes it off afterwards. He's like, that was enough.
Yeah. He's starting to get annoyed and he needs to shake off the annoyance.
Exactly.
Totally.
On the retreats that I assist a few times a year, there will be probably like at least one person each time, they're groups of like 8 or 9 that just gets into this like shaking, whether it's the shaking of their legs or the shaking of their extremities. And it's so interesting to think about just energy that gets trapped in our body, kind of calcified, that needs just a way to be processed externally. A lot of times people won't exactly know, their mind isn't aware. What is this? Where did it start? And our mind wants answers, but just to be in the sensation is really powerful.
Definitely. I've many times shook and like uncontrollably during a psychedelic, right? Because it really is a somehow stored and unexpressed emotion and energy, right? And we still don't quite know scientifically how that works. And I think a lot of people are still skeptical, but they just haven't done enough work to realize that it's true, right? Work on themselves. And but I think somehow in muscular tension, like what it is, muscular tension being released essentially, right? And but our muscles, just like our entire nervous system, is all deeply interconnected with our mind, with our psychology, right? And so the idea that a particular muscle tension in particular muscle cells in your thigh or your hip might be related to a certain set of memories in your hippocampus, let's say, that is a totally plausible thing in terms of our physiology and neurophysiology. But there's still much to be known about how that connection works exactly. But that's something I find really interesting for sure.
Well, it's so complex because you're talking about the research of how is the psychedelic working in the first place, but then also bringing the body into that as well. There's so many layers and so many nuances to this research. So I think in the somatic experiencing one, I'm curious, how do you start to measure that? What does that look like?
It's a matter of bridging different fields, right? Because there's a lot of research that exists on these different topics, but they're siloed, they're distinct. And so it's like, how do we bring things together? You must be familiar with the concept of interoception, or maybe not. Okay, yeah, okay. It is more of a scientific term. So interoception refers to our inner sense of the states of our body. It's contrasted with exteroception. So exteroception, external, extero, right, is our sense of touch, our sense of vision, sense of hearing, our normal senses, right? And interoception, so a sense of within, is interoception, right? It's like our sense of, do I feel hungry? Do I feel tired? Do I feel things in my heart? Or like it's an insight into the internal physiological state of your body. And there's a lot of research on that and how people with mental health conditions have varying ways that they're disconnected from their interoception, or their, you know, they have don't have awareness of their interoceptive processes, or they have a wrong view of it, or they're extremely sensitive, as in certain people with PTSD or anxiety, right? And there's so many things that can happen with interoception. And since interoception is very much a brain-body integration phenomenon, then changes you make in the brain can change how you experience your body through these different pathways, such as through your vagus nerve, for example. You know, the vagus nerve is an interesting one because it links our nervous system regulation, and also our gut and all these physiological signals with our thinking, our hormonal release, our release of inflammatory things in our blood, and all the things, right? And so like there is like deep connections between the brain and body through these different pathways. And so in this paper, which we're still writing, and I actually did a presentation on it for a summit recently, and I could give you the link to the recording that potentially put in the show notes for the viewers, outlines the different ways how psychedelics effects on particular brain receptors in the brain can then influence our interoception and felt experience of the body, and how it might help facilitate emotional catharsis and the release of stored energy and all that. So that's the model in a nutshell that I'm building.
That's so cool. And it's so beautiful that I've never heard that word before, interoception, but it's the felt sense of our inner landscape and our inner world. Mm-hmm. And let me know if this is kind of congruent with what you're studying, but it feels like maybe in a traumatic experience where it's not safe to feel the bigness or the magnitude of what's happening, we might sort of sever. There might be a real biological need to sever the tie to our inner experience because it's so overwhelming for folks.
100%. That's exactly it. And there's a lot of research showing that. Like a lot of people with depression, for example, have learned that it's not safe to be in their body. And so they've reduced interoceptive awareness. They're just not connected to their bodily states, their feeling states. And for PTSD, it can go either way. You can either be hypersensitive, hypervigilant and detecting fear and threat and everything, or you're dissociated and you're shut down and completely disconnected. You can go either way, and there's people with either way who have a lot of trauma. And so this is really just a dysfunction of interoceptive processing through particular brain circuits. And so, yeah, it's super, super interesting.
Which is why so much of talk therapy, the trope is, and how do you feel about that? Where do you feel that in your body? Because it's perhaps a big part of it is just trying to recreate this connection between a person and their felt inner state.
Yeah, definitely. And there's reason to think that psychedelics can really catalyze that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of like the menu that you shared before of all these different practices and how many of them are likely just getting you into this interior world, this rich interior world that we all inhabit.
Definitely. I think that's a large part of it, right? Because ultimately for me, a core part of just growth and development is connection to self, connection to the internal, right? Because it's so easy to get caught up in the external, right? It's like constant stimulation, constant information, influences from parents, from culture, from whatever. And how do we find ourselves in all that unless we're connected internally to ourselves? Because everything is trying to manipulate our attention. There's hundreds of millions of dollars going into that all the time. And, you know, and if we're not connected to ourselves, we're just going to be pulled there, then there, then there, then there. Then we wonder like, oh, I don't know who I am. I don't know what my purpose is. I feel lost. And it's like, it's because people are not connected to their inner felt sense, right? And so you need these practices to bring back stillness and calmness and safety within the nervous system and body to start to then feel into what's real for me. What do I truly want to do? Like what I want to do, not like this whole mix of things, right? And that's not easy. And it's not that many people are able to connect to that, to become connected to that, because our culture doesn't serve it. You got to really be almost a renegade to go pursue that, right?
But yes,
hopefully that's changing. And I think psychedelics can help people, again, when used in the right way, to open up to that.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of people about psychedelics where it feels like you're able to access the state as if you'd been dutifully meditating every day for 10 years. You're able to almost like short circuit and get to that state. And then hopefully through integration, you're able to build that in a sustainable way without psychedelics in your inner psyche. But I feel like everything you're talking about, Manesh, goes back to what you started talking about, which is how do you start your day? Is it externally through your phone or any other distraction, or is it internally?
Totally. Yeah, so important. One way to say it is like, are you living proactively or reactively?
So I'd love to break it down into just like a simple practice. You said that you meditate for 5 minutes throughout the day. It's likely to get back to your sense, your felt sense of yourself, despite all of the many meetings and different things that you're doing throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So could you walk someone through just like a 30-second practice to be back in their body or their felt sense of self?
For sure. So what I do is like, I first notice tension I'm holding in my face and in my stomach. Because that's where I notice when I'm in the head, my face, my jaw is a bit more clenched. My stomach might be contracted. So the first thing I do is drop my facial muscles and drop my stomach and just try to get physically as relaxed and light as possible. And then from that space, I'll often do a bit of, I guess, pranayama breathing, where I'll do 8 second inhale, 8 second hold, 8 second exhale. And I'll do that, you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 times. And then I'll just try to stabilize in, I suppose, being mindful, just being totally present of letting thoughts come up and not pursue them, but stay grounded in the body in this relaxed state. And I notice as soon as I lose awareness of what I'm doing, there's the tension returns immediately in my face. And so that's always a signal, oh, relax. Oh, there's like 10% of tension. Oh, that came back, drop it. And if you're in a totally relaxed physical state, you have to be present, right? So you know you're present when that's happening. And as soon as there's tension, like, oh, there was a part of you that wasn't present.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I could feel it as I relaxed my, there's so many small little muscles that are engaged when you're in conversation, when you're thinking. It's a really powerful and simple practice for people to start employing in their life. You talked about the gut, the belly, which I find to be really interesting as well. I'm curious if that comes into your research at all, just our connection with our gut and how we metabolize psychedelics, usually through the mouth and in the gut.
Yeah, it's an interesting untapped area in terms of the relationship between psychedelics and the microbiome, right? Because we know from a lot of research that the nature of bacteria in your microbiome are correlated with inflammation throughout our brain and body, and also correlated with basically every mental health condition there is. You know, people have talked about autism as a kind of like a microbiome disorder even, because there's like so many links. And it's so fascinating to think that we think these are psychological processes. Our depression, anxiety, you know, PTSD, ADHD, autism, that's all psychological. It's the brain. But there's very strong correlations with the nature of bacteria in our gut. And this is because, among other things, there are receptors in our gut that feed directly to the brain, actually through the vagus nerve, which I talked about before, which can change the levels of neurotransmitters in our brain, which can modulate neuroplasticity, and which can also lead to increased or reduced inflammation. And all that stuff has a major impact on our psychological experience and our cognitive functioning. And so there is some research showing how psychedelics can change the nature of our microbiome, but it's super preliminary and early. There's not that much of it. And it's also just very difficult to study that a lot of the time. Really, we need to move into this view of mental health and psychedelic treatment as this complete holistic brain, body, nervous system thing, right? It's like not just the brain, it's our gut. It's our felt sense of the feeling states of our body. It's our attunement with, you know, our various organs, systems and all that, and how much inflammation we have and what our endocrine system is doing hormonally, and our mitochondrial function, how our mitochondria and energy metabolism working, because those are deeply intertwined with mental health as well. It's like, we're just realizing everything is so interconnected and we can't just take one piece of the puzzle and pretend it's the whole thing.
Right. In the same way that your car doesn't run just by putting wheels on a spoke, the car runs because it's the composite of all these parts. And I think it's actually interesting as well. I feel like a lot of folks, when they come back from a psychedelic journey, they can, you know, see God or have these transcendental experiences, but then bringing it down into the basics, the message is often maybe shift a little bit of your diet, maybe shift the fuel that you're giving your vehicle. And I think that's an interesting just relationship.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. It is very true. It's like you have glimpses into the nature of the universe, but then you bring it back into seemingly very simple and banal changes. Like, oh, be a bit nicer to my little brother, or spend more time with my mom, or call a friend more often, right? But like, it's true. Those things and what they represent internally, especially, like, make a big difference.
Is AI making its way? I know you mentioned AI and studying the gait, a person's gait, and saying there's so much that we can actually study by the way they hold themselves, which I very much believe in. I feel like hunched shoulders might be, you know, withdrawn, or I'm carrying too much, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm curious if AI has made its way into your research at all. If you see the future of AI and anything, this is kind of like out of left field, but just curious.
You know, living here in San Francisco, I get that question all the time.
Oh, you do? Okay.
So AI is such a broad term, right? AI can mean a whole variety of things. One way, quote unquote, AI, I think, is coming into the psychedelic research is in terms of analyzing trip reports. So natural language processing and applying like language learning models like ChatGPT style models to parse long transcribed descriptions of people's experiences. That's starting to happen, of trying to get more nuanced views of people's experiences and like the themes that are common. And you can even extract emotions from the nature of the text, right? Using sentiment analysis, as it's called. But there's various different algorithms and ways to analyze long text reports that we couldn't do before. And so I know researchers, and Robin and I have actually talked to researchers about it. It's like finding ways to do that, to link it to the brain and have a better understanding of the phenomenology of psychedelic experiences. So that's one way to do it. And I mean, AI machine learning things are being used to help develop new molecules that have a similar molecular structure, but which might affect the brain, you know, slightly differently in potentially therapeutically useful ways. And so there's a lot of machine learning and computational ways of doing that. And then there's the whole concept of AI assistants or AI therapists, right? And that, I mean, people are exploring that too, but I'm not convinced that that's going to replace real therapists or, you know, make a huge difference at this point. But people are exploring that, as well as in combination with virtual reality to curate different experiences. So naturally, people are trying to come up with all the ideas for their startups, but we'll see what sticks.
I think it's exciting. I do. Even hearing like AI assistants or AI therapists as a therapist, I'm like, yes, great. Make as much of this information as accessible as possible. But replicating the reparative nature of the human to human interaction, I think will likely not be outsourced for quite some time, if ever.
Yeah, totally.
What else haven't we covered in terms of what makes you feel that makes you feel most excited to be in this field right now?
I think for me, moving forward, I'm really interested in psychedelics for healthy people, right? For, you know, because it's so important and valuable to bring people who are not feeling well to be at baseline and well, whatever well means. That's a whole other topic of what it means to be healthy. But then there's like, what are the upper reaches of human potential, right? what does it mean to be more, you know, creative and expansive and living in more harmony with more meaning and purpose and having more of an open heart to connect with others and be in service from a place of selflessness and all these beautiful traits and qualities that emerge for people who are more quote unquote developed in certain ways, right? And I think psychedelics can help facilitate that as a tool alongside other things. But psychedelics potential to do that has not really been studied yet because we've been focusing so much on treating mental health conditions. And it's really interesting to think how our culture with the emergence of psychedelics immediately puts it in this box of treating mental health conditions. You know, it's like these are compounds which allow us to transcend ourselves, maybe feel like we're merging with God and have these exalted states of blissful union and love and all that. It's like, oh, we can treat mental health conditions with that. It's, you know, it's a beautiful application, but it's such a reduction of what the potential is here. And it's so like a product of our particular culture and the problems within it, right? And so I'm really curious on how psychedelics can be used to amplify creativity in different ways and everything I just mentioned. Let's go beyond healthy to thriving, being more of an integrated, developed person. And so that's something I really want to get into more. And like it's basically a psychedelics and transformation beyond just, you know, treating something that seems to be not healthy. Yeah, there's one organization that I've been talking with called the Center for Minds. And they're great because they're trying to push psychedelics. They're calling it psychedelic assisted innovative thinking or something like that. Psychedelic assisted innovation. That's their tagline. And they're all about using psychedelics to help come to novel solutions and creative ideas regarding science or engineering or, you know, socio-cultural problems and all that. And seeing how psychedelics can really help people push the grain in terms of their thinking and have new insights that are practical and useful in the world, as opposed to just being about their own personal lives.
I'm so hearing you talk about it. I'm like, of course, that seems like the natural conclusion is if our world leaders, instead of just pushing forward in this sort of hyper-masculine way, if there was actually more femininity, meaning more receptivity, more listening, more taking the time out of our lives to just journey and to listen and to hear and to be with the interior world, I think there could be these pretty seismic shifts in how we move forward as a society to remember our interconnectedness. There's so much power in psychedelic shaping the future of our planet.
Definitely. I think like a hyper rational, hyper reason through every little step based on your past knowledge, like the hyper masculine view is like not the whole picture, obviously, and leading us wherever the biases people have are. Because like, if you're not listening, you're not receptive, you're not open to alternative views and just like coming from this greater place of spontaneity and receptivity, then you're just dialing in whatever you already know, whatever is already in your mind. And that's limited. It's relative to you. It's like a small piece of the pie. And you're just like diving into that. And that's what people do, right? And that's why we get stuck in these ruts where we're not seeing the whole, we're not seeing the broader systems level perspective. We're not allowing ourselves to explore new ideas and step out of ourselves.
I had a friend who did his first ketamine journey a few weeks ago, and he came out of this hour-long journey and he looked at me and he's like, Nadia, if only everyone all over the world could just have the hour that I just had. Like, I saw beauty, I saw peace, I was at peace with myself. It's so much clearer where I'm heading in my life. I feel so much love for the people in my life and people that aren't in my life. And just not every journey will be like that, but it's such a powerful experience.
Yeah, totally. And I want to jump, like, it's a good point that not every journey will be like that. Because I think we should be careful of saying that psychedelics will solve all things. You'll take it and you'll have a beautiful experience every time. It's always going to be positive. I think people can have very, very negative, fearful, anxiety-producing experiences that could really harm them psychologically. And these are things not to be used in a like haphazard way of just taking them. They have to be approached with a lot of respect and reverence and preparation and knowing what you're doing and in the right context with the right mindset and all the things in order for it to be potentially positive and useful in these ways, right? So it's, yeah, I just really want to hammer that point in that this is not go take psychedelics in whatever context and it's all going to be magical. The thing with psychedelics, actually, that's the most reliable characteristic is that they're dependent on context. There is no psychedelic experience. There's just an infinite variety of psychedelic experiences, which are based on, you know, your own expectations, culture, beliefs, intention, psychological, physical, emotional state, and then also who are you around and all of these things, right? Where you are. It's like a total complex mixture of all these things, and with an added element of unpredictability. You have no clue where it might go. And so they're powerful tools, but can be volatile. And then that's why containing them and using them in a very conscious way is so important.
Yeah. I have, the more that I witness journeys, the more reverence that I have, the more humility that I have. You have no idea what a person's psyche, the healing intelligence of that person will bring to the fore. And it's incredibly humbling and it's incredibly mystical. And I really appreciate the ethics, I think, is what you're bringing into this. The morality of this is how to be in right relationship with these medicines and not see them as a silver bullet, but see them as a much broader conversation, which I think is exciting. The research that you're doing will hopefully lead to kind of like more openness around these substances. And yet we also need a lot of reverence as well.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Well, Manesh, thank you so much for coming onto The Current. Is there any last point that you'd like to leave people with as a tool for contemplation today?
I think just to hammer in what we've talked about and the importance of stillness and connection to self and taking time to be in silence every day. That itself will make a big difference. It's like it could be 5 minutes, 10 minutes if you don't already have that. Just of like doing nothing, of not being on your phone. You don't need to be meditating. You could just be sitting there and being with yourself and feeling like, how do I feel in this moment? What's going on for me in my mind, in my body? Am I agitated? Am I grounded? Am I whatever? And why might that be the case? How can I relax more and let go of what I'm not letting go of? I think that doing that on the daily is so, so important, because a lot of the issues people face are cumulative. They're like many, many days of something undealt with. Then it escalates into something really big. But if you're cutting that every single day, how is it going to build? It's not going to build, not nearly as much, and therefore it's easier to navigate. So just the importance of silence and stillness.
Beautiful. And I think it's a simple, short call to action for folks to bring into their daily lives. It doesn't have to be some big, wild psychedelic experience necessarily. It's the simplicity of silence and stillness.
Totally. But yeah, thanks so much for having me, Nadia. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed this conversation a lot.
Thanks, Manesh. We'll include a lot of what you talked about in the show notes for people to explore more.